Hi, and welcome back to the Childhood Development Initiative's Restorative Practice podcast, where we talk all things RP. For this second season, we resume visiting communities and organisations to collect stories from practitioners around Ireland. We talk to young people, teachers, lecturers, youth and community workers, and restorative practices trainers to gather their insights on the impact of RP in their life and work. Each episode is focusing either on a place with several voices or on a practitioner. If you are not familiar with restorative practices, the restorative approach, the restorative questions, and the work CDI does, you can listen to the first episode of season one of our podcast series where it is all explained.
Hi, I'm Dorothy Danu, Restorative Practices Quality Specialist for CDI, and I'm delighted to be back on the road for the second season of Circles of Connection. For this episode, I went back to Maynooth University, where I met with John Biggins, who is a lawyer and academic and very knowledgeable on the Brehan laws. So the idea was to answer the question, where are ancestors more restorative than us? Thank you very much, John, for taking part in this interview. I'm delighted to be here again in Maynooth. And would you please introduce yourself to our listeners?
So firstly, Gaurav Mahagut, Dorothy, for having me on your podcast. It's a privilege to be here. My profile is somewhat eclectic. So I'm a lawyer by education and training. During my master's, I did my thesis on early Irish law and looked at some lessons it may hold for modern law reform. I thoroughly enjoyed that research. It opened my eyes to a heritage I had only been vaguely aware of up until that point. But I had many other interests too. I graduated from my master's in 2009 in the midst of the financial crisis, and life took me in a different direction. I initially went into academic research in the area of financial regulation and then spent a number of years as a regulatory professional in the public sector. I've recently returned to a more academic setting, including here at Maynooth, and this has given me more space to reacquaint myself with early Irish law. My particular research interest is to connect this native legal heritage to the broader arc of Irish legal history and from a comparative law perspective across time. I'm also keen to promote awareness of this heritage more broadly, not least within and beyond mainstream legal academia and practice. While historically championed by academics in areas such as Celtic studies and Irish, it still remains something of a blind spot in mainstream legal education and practice. Now, in trying to do this, I, of course, benefit from the fact that a good proportion of the early Irish law tracts have now been translated from older forms of the Irish language into English. Similar to most Irish people, even my modern Irish is a work in progress. So it will otherwise be much more challenging to access this heritage if those translations were not already available. Added to that has been the Trojan research and analytical work of philologists, historians, genealogists, and many others over time. So this has added great context and depth to our understanding of how these laws may have worked and influenced legal and social practices at different points in time, from the medieval into the early modern period. So I very much stand on the shoulders of all of those who have laid the foundations for the likes of me to try and talk about this legal system. It's also a really good time to be having this conversation, particularly given that we're in a centenary period of the foundation of the Irish state. And the native laws have, I think, been somewhat overlooked in the official centenary reflections. So no better place than this podcast to get a conversation going about them.
Often we mention that restorative approaches were dominant in Ireland until they were overtaken by the British common law, and that the Brehan laws are a form of restorative justice. And we often say that restorative practices such as circles involving the different stakeholders in an incident were common practice. How much are these statements true? And did our ancestors have a more restorative approach to relationship and wrongdoing? So that's really the question we are trying to answer today. And to do that, because it's so broad, I suggest we go through some elements of the restorative approach and see from your point of view how they existed or were enacted in the Brehan laws. And from there, what we can realistically imagine of what was happening in reality at the time. So maybe to start with, What are the Brehon laws and how do we know about it? And what are their history?
So like every legal system, this had a number of complexities and nuances. But in the limited time we have, I can certainly attempt a broad overview. I'll mainly be focused here on early Irish law. So firstly, the phrase Brehon law is itself an anglicization or a colloquialism for the old Irish word for judge, Brehim. It's also worth noting the old Irish for judgment was breth. One of the technical terms used by early Irish jurists themselves when referring to these laws was fainicus, laws of the freeman. And I'll return to that notion of being a freeman shortly. The majority of the Irish law tracts emerged between the 7th and 8th centuries under the influence of early Christian learning and writing, which had taken root around the 5th century. To an extent, the law tracts codified a pre-existing oral legal tradition, and on linguistic grounds, it has been suggested that some of the material could be traced back to as early as around 1000 BC. It seems this oral tradition was originally passed on from generation to generation through archaic forms of poetic verse and short legal maxims. These different styles are reflected as well in the drafting of the law tracts themselves. The actual practice of law on the ground would still, though, have continued to be a primarily oral tradition. What survived today are mostly 14th to 16th century copies of copies of those original texts guarded by hereditary legal families. Over 100 law tracts survive in some form, and it's known that others were partially or fully lost to time. They cover a very broad range of topics in significant detail. Now, the surviving manuscripts are layered texts with interpretations and commentaries from different time periods. It should also be stressed that Irish law formed part of a much broader mutually reinforcing tradition or wisdom, Shankas, which incorporated poetry, history, genealogy, mythology, and so on. And now, Irish law differed from other European legal traditions in the sense that it wasn't issued or developed by a centralized political or royal authority. Now, there were some exceptions, such as a form of law known as coin, usually issued jointly by royal and ecclesiastical authorities. But there wasn't really a central political authority in early medieval Ireland. Rather, the island was divided into a large number of small competitive territories, known as tuatha, some more powerful than others. The laws were mostly composed and copied by professional jurists who had a mixture of legal, poetic, and ecclesiastical training. So this professional class built a broadly common legal culture throughout the island, albeit with some local or regional variations. Now, we can't, though, be sure to what extent the Brehon laws, as written down, were faithfully applied in society at any given time. Written records of individual case outcomes or agreements for the early medieval period are lacking, though such records have been found for later centuries. But this lack of case law, so to speak, is not unique to early Irish law. And anyway, we can still form some general impressions of society from the law tracts. What we can say is that the Ireland depicted in the Brehon laws was a mixed farming society. It was also hierarchical and patriarchal. We also know from various sources that this could be a violent place, especially at the political levels. The Brehon laws also facilitated harsh punishments in some circumstances. They suggest that not everyone in society had full legal capacity. There were free and unfree classes. For example, status depended on gender. Surprise, surprise, it was better to be male. Whether one had a profession or standing, property and wealth, particularly in terms of cattle. So these factors determined a person's societal and legal status. So in that sense, the Brehon laws seem to apply unevenly to different segments of society, and it's important that we put them into their proper historical and social context. But that being said, the Brehon laws did contain community-centered, pragmatic legal rules from which we can learn and which I'm sure we'll be getting into shortly.
So we can imagine that the progressive change of system going together with colonization and more oppression is traumatic for communities. And maybe it explains also the romanticization of some aspect of the legal system in ancient Ireland. Do we know how the transition from what we think was the era of the Brehon Laws to the British Common Law. Do we know how this transition was lived?
So there's a couple of elements to your question there. Firstly, I think it's fair to say the Brehon Laws have been romanticized to some degree. Some of that is justified and some of it perhaps not. On the broader question of transition from Brehon Law to common law from the late 12th century, there are many complexities and nuances that we obviously can't get into here, but some broad points can be made. It's mostly, I think, a story of gradual evolution. But of course, as political affairs ebbed and flowed, common law authority itself waxed and waned. Initially, there was no full-scale invasion of Ireland and no immediate general extension of the common law either. So Brehon Law continued to be an influence in parts of the country right up into the 17th century. There are instances where agreements, particularly regarding land inheritance and land transactions in the Brehon mold, were recognised even in the colonial courts. And indeed, even in areas of Anglo or Hiberno-Norman administration, some Brehon Law principles and personnel were co-opted over time. Not only that, the colonial authorities saw advantage in explicitly adopting certain Brehon principles in the interests of pragmatism and stability in the colony. So, for instance, a version of the Brehon custom of collective kin liability, or kin coggish, for offences committed by an individual member of a kin, which we'll come back to, was enshrined in legislation at various points by the colonial authorities. In terms of lived experiences with transition, we have some records with respect to issues faced by the native or Gaelic Irish in areas where common law was applied. There may, however, well have been differences in attitudes depending on whether the Gaelic Irish in question were living peacefully in the colonial areas or not. And outcomes probably varied across time and place, given that this was also just a period of flux of the common law itself becoming embedded in the jurisdiction. So, for example, based on an interpretation of 14th century records, it has been suggested that if a homicide was committed against an Irishman, the accused might be acquitted on the basis that the deceased was Irish. While not automatic, it would then be open to the lord of the killed Irishman, so the noble lord, but not the deceased kin, to sue the killer. But this is an echo of a Brehon compensation-based principle, albeit weighted more favourably towards the noble classes. Beyond that then, on the flip side, if an Irishman was convicted of the death of an Englishman, or for example of arson and so on, the penalty was hanging under the common law. Now, while hanging was also known to Brehon law, the usual penalty would have been compensation-based. And again, we'll return to that, I'm sure, shortly. So the picture might be that some native Irish seem to suffer perhaps the worst of both worlds from a restorative standpoint in the emerging colony. Now, later on, the Tudor conquest or reconquest of the 16th century, Gaelic military losses in the early 17th century, and a royal proclamation in 1603 saw an extension of the common law more broadly. This was also followed by judicial attacks on Brehon systems of land succession. Still, the Brehon law has been detected in certain deeds and agreements well into the 17th century. Now, later on in the early 18th century, Brehon land law principles were resurrected, but for nefarious purposes, in what were called the penal laws. This was an effort to weaken Catholic landowners by subjecting them to the Brehon principle of land subdivision between all surviving sons, as opposed to just the eldest under the common law, and so in that way would have undermined large landholdings. Now, further on again, during the land war in the 19th century, and in the writings, for instance, of James Connolly in the early 20th, there was a definite romanticisation of some aspects of the Brehon laws, not least the Brehon land laws. And some English commentators also bought into this. Now, a lot of those perceptions of the Brehon land laws were perhaps more imagined than real. And certainly the concept that poorer Irish would necessarily have been better off under the Brehon land laws is certainly arguable.
So restorative justice is described as a change of lands, if we take the expression from Howard there, a change of lands from retributive justice. In retributive justice, crime is seen as a violation of law, whereas in restorative justice, crime is seen as a violation of people and relationships. In retributive justice, the state determines guilt and punishments. The focus is on offenders getting what they deserve. Whereas in restorative justice, the idea is to put things right between the different people involved, and the focus is on community, victims' needs, and offenders' responsibility. So with this wide idea of the change of lens and the differences between the two systems, what is the perspective in the Brehan laws, and can you give examples?
There was no distinct criminal law system in the modern sense in early Ireland, so it lacked a centralized justice and police apparatus. The concept of restitution, though, or making good, is referenced in a number of places. And added to that are general legal principles which ran through the whole system, such as fear, truth or justice, and curt, fairness. Illegal acts were usually addressed through a kind of privately enforced and complex regime of fines, depending on the nature and circumstances of the offence, the rank of the victim, and so on. It's probable that a combination of the status and honour of the people involved, supported by personal items made in pledge to settle an issue, combined with the use of personal guarantors in the community, would have ensured enforcement of fines in most cases. Payments had to be made a short time after the commission of an offence or a judgment, as the case may be. Now, the penalty for most offences against the person in the Brehan laws typically had what's called an honour price component, known as dire, reflecting the rank of the victim or their kin. And then, depending on the offence, an additional body fine, known as eric or crow, might be added to reflect its seriousness. So this idea of honour and affronts to honour very much being a core in this context. So, for example, in the case of murder, an eric penalty was payable to the victim's kin, plus honour price, payable based on the status of the victim's kin. So, for example, a man would receive full honour price for the killing of his father or mother. Now, if a victim lived after an offence, additional penalties could be due if an injury proved permanent, which would be assessed in what's called an after judgment. So, for example, a permanent leg injury would require the provision of a horse by the perpetrator, plus an extra fine. If a victim of rape fell pregnant, the rapist was responsible for rearing the child. Offences against property were treated a bit differently. For example, theft penalties were calculated with reference to the value of the object and the rank of its owner. One law tract, influenced by canon law, suggests that if a sheep was stolen, four must be returned. If a cow or an ox was stolen, five cows or oxen must be returned. If a pig or a horse was stolen, the perpetrator must return twice what was stolen. But the Brehan laws also contain principles of proportionality. So some acts technically equivalent to theft were permitted. For example, items taken from a burning building, scrap metal from a forge, morsels of food by down and out people. But I would say one of the best examples of the Brehan law focus on community and victims' needs and offenders' responsibility was in the process of what's called sick maintenance, or UTRIS. Under sick maintenance, where illegal physical injury was inflicted, the victim was initially brought to their own home, where they were looked after by their kin for a period of 9 or 10 days. At that point, a physician would formally examine the victim and determine whether they had recovered, in which case only an injury payment was required from the perpetrator. If the physician deemed the victim to be mortally wounded, so known as suffering a bloodline of death, a heavy fine was payable. But if the victim was in need of further nursing after the initial period, and the physician believed they would live, they were taken away on sick maintenance. The perpetrator brought the injured person to the home of a third party, likely a kinsman of the perpetrator themselves, and nursed them at their own expense. They were responsible for ensuring the victim was maintained appropriately with food and drink, which in turn depended on the rank of the victim. The offender was also expected to provide hospitality for a victim's associates, if they had any, to provide entertainment and arrange for a substitute to stand in for the victim's normal working duties. At the end of sick maintenance, the physician would give a verdict on the health of the victim. an assessment of the amount due for the injury was likely made by a judge. Now, there were no doubt practical challenges in all of this, and that may be a strong explanatory factor as to why the practice appears to have been abandoned at some point in time. So over time, a number of classes of people, especially of higher rank, became exempt from this obligation in relation to sick maintenance, with a fine payable instead. So there is that view that the whole thing probably became obsolete by the early 8th century, replaced instead by a single nursing fine or payment, reflecting the costs of food, missed work, and medical fees. But still, for however long it lasted and was applied, the whole process must have ensured a deep and intimate involvement by the offender in the recovery of the victim, and indeed the kind of broader community in that sense. And elements of performance and ritual were also evident, and these surely helped signal to both the immediate parties and the community that this was to be resolved peacefully. But it is also important to highlight that there were situations in which legitimate violence and retributive aspects, the Breton laws, can be detected. So particularly if a fine for an offence went unpaid, things could dangerously escalate for an offender. So a condemned person could be killed potentially or sold into slavery, unless they might be, for example, ransomed by their own kinsmen and so on. If a killer was at large, the victim's kinsmen were obliged to undertake a blood feud to exact vengeance. So the starting point very much being a fine-based regime, and with some older features of this kind of very intimate sick maintenance regime. But certainly there were circumstances in which, in default, a more retributive regime could come into play.
Yeah, and it's interesting that the system was decided, not, you know, we would say written, but it doesn't make any sense for the, but the fines were decided, so there were no negotiation between the offenders and the perpetrators around what needs to happen to repair. But there was really the idea of reparation rather than retribution, except that it was not negotiated, it was written. And yeah, I can see also the focus on community in the sense that it is, the idea is to, so it's a very hierarchical society. So the idea is that if something has happened and harm has been done or incidents have occurred, we need to come back to restore the community as it was. So the whole thing around ranks and, you know, the fines depending on your ranks. So it's really difficult to compare with our system in the sense that we are not in a society not explicitly exactly, like, yeah, that's interesting, not explicitly, yeah. And then as you said, some aspects are really retributive. So restorative practices are going towards less professionalization and are more community based. So, and you mentioned already something about practitioner. So in the restorative justice and practices field at the moment, practitioners are coming from all sorts of backgrounds and are practicing in their day-to-day life or work system, and even for restorative justice process, although there is a legal framework in the justice system, the actors are not necessarily the usual ones, the judge, the lawyers. And even some restorative justice processes are designed to divert people from the centralized justice system, for example, with your young offenders. So you've mentioned that already a bit, but was there a centralized system in ancient Ireland? From what you said, no. But then who were the practitioners and how much embedded in the community was it?
So yeah, I think it's a very interesting question. There was no centralized justice system in early Ireland in the sense of certain types of cases going up to a central court or location. Some more serious issues might be referred to a prominent king or ecclesiastic in some situations, but that seems to have been fairly rare. So there was also no public law enforcement apparatus in the way that we would recognize it today. The overall system was more so geared towards private, local resolution of legal disputes. Courts at this time were more like arbitration venues. They didn't have automatic compulsory jurisdiction. So actually getting people to court was probably also a bit of a struggle. The preference, therefore, was to try and resolve issues through non-court avenues, and reliance was placed on members of the immediate community to that end. So there was this concept I mentioned earlier on of the corporate or kin liability, whereby a kinsman could be held responsible for the defaults and certain offences of a family member who could not pay or had disappeared. Kinsmen could have their property seized by complaints or creditors for the transgressions of the family member. So they were very much in the frame in the broader family sense in those situations. Now, if kin liability was invoked, the offender in turn had to make good the liabilities incurred by their kinsman. So if the kinsman had stepped forward to meet the liability or obligation, then the offending kinsman had to in turn make good those liabilities back to their family. So all of this would encourage, it can be expected, a degree of mutual accountability within and between kin groups in the community, and probably a good degree of mutual surveillance in that sense. Beyond that, we can also imagine from what we see that cattle lords, so noble lords in the community, in economic relationships with the farmers in the community, likely played key roles in the social and legal system. So lords might act as guarantors on behalf of their client farmers and were entitled to a proportion of the fine in the event that their clients were illegally killed. Lords also had a role in maintaining cross-border legal stability between different territories. So they might aim to ensure complaints could be quickly settled in the community. So they're sort of individuals of high standing in the community who could help to bring matters to settlement. When it came to higher up in the political spectrum, local kings in the early Irish period were not lawmakers as such in any kind of substantial way, it seems. They didn't, as I mentioned earlier on, put together the main early Irish law codes. But they did have some role, it seems, in law enforcement and potentially some judgments. They also took pledges, so again, items of personal worth from their subjects, who pledged to observe the laws in the community. So kind of a peremptory way to ensure law observance. And more generally, they would have maintained law and order through their retinues and through sort of quasi-military men in the community. The poets in the community as well, so these kind of intellectuals, if you like, might also have had a role in the resolution of disputes. So you can think of the poets as like the early Irish equivalents of influencers. They could use their skills of satire to ensure accountability in the community. So satire might take the form of a statement, a nickname, a poetic verse about a person, an innuendo, and so on. This could have very serious implications for someone's reputation, which was massive in the community, and hence their honor in this status-conscious society. Poetic satire was regulated by a type of prior warning procedure as well. So there was an opportunity for the community to come forward and to make the matter okay before they were subject to the full rigors of a satire. Beyond that then, the agnata, or the advocates, sort of the equivalent of modern day barristers, emerged over time as well, and they had seemingly become embedded by the 9th century. It's probable that the barristers and the judges were exposed to the same training in the law schools, which itself would have been quite broad, incorporating law, poetry, and other disciplines. These professionals were mainly activated when a case got to court, but they might also have a role in guiding people on certain legal procedures within the community. So you can imagine that the early barrister would have had a role in shepherding more complex processes of community dispute settlement and so on. And finally, just a note on juvenile offenders in the Breton laws. Offences by children were normally borne by their father or their foster father while they were on fosterage. And now there were though some exceptions to the liability of children. And again, coming back to the status element of society, the children of higher ranking individuals like kings, bishops, poets, offences by them would likely be very difficult to remedy given the high status nature of their parent. So just to flag that up as a passing observation on the juvenile aspect as well in the Breton laws.
Yeah, so it's very it's a mix of professional and a mix of people that are really working in the community. Just it's And I imagine, considering the complexity of the rules, you need to go through. So it's really something in between a kind of very oral system of, kind of on-site negotiation and our system, which is, completely relying on knowledge of the on the knowledge and the interpretation that professional can do of the law.
Yeah, I'd say a sliding scale is the right way of thinking about it. Yeah. And that kind of hybrid scenario of both non-professional and professional, yeah.
So restorative practices offer a different setting. It's mostly circle-based for equality and orality. Do we know anything about the practices in ancient Ireland? How did the processes look like? Was it circle-based or very hierarchical like a trial? I am assuming it's also because RP promotes orality and performative utterance, so an apology is a reparation, that the connection with the ancient system is made. But, tell me more about that.
Yeah, I think in terms of apology, I don't get the sense in general that apology simpliciter in the Brehon laws was usually sufficient to remedy the situation. It was normally, I imagine, a recognition of wrongdoing and then a meeting of the relevant obligations that follow from that wrongdoing. So on the apology aspect, I don't get a sense, certainly from my research to date, that in and of itself would have solved the issue in most cases. But I would say nonetheless that the Brehon laws had elements of both, I think, that community and that hierarchical aspect. So where a legal obligation or dispute initially arose, it could, as mentioned, draw in a number of stakeholders in the community, right? They would have had various roles and interests in resolving and stabilizing the situation. There were a number of specific mechanisms through which community-based resolution could be achieved. Now, one such mechanism I've mentioned already in passing was the pledge, whereby an item of personal worth could be put up as an indication of good faith that a complaint or default would be voluntarily settled or else referred to arbitration. It was also possible for third parties to put up pledges on someone else's behalf in return, usually for interest. So in that sense, there was this possibility that in the community, processes of good faith were adhered to in the posting of personal items of worth. It might be a cup, for example, something like that. Now, the item would be forfeit if there was failure to resolve or settle. An insight into the oral performance of pledging can be gleaned from a fragment of the law tracts, which relates to the designation of a craftsman's property as a pledge. The translation reads as follows: "Tie a withe about his anvil and give notice that he is not to work any material on it until he shall have done right by you in respect of what you are claiming from him." Another way of settling legal complaints outside the court was via a process known as distraint or atcabal, taking back. Now, given how complex the process was, it was likely done under the advice of lawyers in the community. It basically involved the complainant or victim progressively seizing property, usually livestock, of the alleged wrongdoer. And the normal procedure was called distraint with a stay. So firstly, the plaintiff had to give formal notice to the defendant of an intention to impound property. A grace period would then run, the exact length depending on the nature of the dispute. During the grace period, the defendant could put matters right by paying the appropriate fine. Alternatively, they could give a pledge to indicate their willingness to settle. If not, the livestock could be moved to a pound and after a further delay, was progressively forfeit. We get some insight from the relevant law tract into how the oral performance of the notification of distraint might have been performed. So the translation is, "Let notification be hastily dispatched back along the route. Let two persons be nominated together with a witness. Let them go first to the green of the man from whose land the distress is taken away, and after that to the abode of the man in whose holding it's declared to be pounded. With announcement of three things: liability, pound, advocate. The liability for which it's taken, the pound where it's been kept in custody, the advocate who represents." Failing these community-driven procedures, a case could end up before a Brehon court in the following way. Initially, a public assertion of truth, likely carried out by the victim, their representatives or relatives, was carried out. Fault might be conceded by the accused immediately, so they might come to terms by pledging a personal item of value that they would settle the matter. The fine then would be paid, so the relevant fine for the offence would be paid, the pledge would be returned, and the matter would stay out of court. But if fault was not conceded, legal action was necessary, and this usually required the services, surprise, surprise, of the lawyers. The first stage was fixing a hearing date. Pleading took place at the court before one or more judges. Minor cases may have been heard at judges' houses. Larger, more serious cases probably were heard in open-air assemblies. So we can imagine the hearing of cases on hilltops and so on. The actual conduct of a court case in early Ireland had many parallels with what we would recognise today in a court setting. So the bringing together of a number of parties connected to the dispute, witnesses, personal guarantors, and so on. The hearing of testimony, pleading on the part of lawyers from both sides, and so forth. So the actual procedures look eerily similar once it got to the court to those that we'd recognize today.
Yes, so there are more ways to avoid that, but the final court processes are quite formal, like we have. So there is also a proactive element in restorative practices. It's about consciously building healthy relationships and prevent conflict through regular check-ins, circles, the use of language that enhance connection. Do we know of practices that had this role? So the role of community building and of enhancing the healthy relationships in the community.
Certainly, and I would say an excellent example was in the law of neighbourhood, or comicasa. So in the law of neighbourhood, all neighbouring farmers were expected to give each other an object of value as a forepledge, so before anything had gone wrong. This is different from a pledge given after something had gone wrong, at the beginning of each sort of farming season, shall we say. This was to anticipate possible offences against land in particular, especially what was called grazing trespass by animals across boundaries. So in regular cases of grazing trespass, where there were no aggravating circumstances, the forepledge then would become forfeit. So further legal action was unnecessary, and a disruption of relations between neighbours was kept to a minimum. Now, within this is a very interesting notion that even bees could trespass. And this was actually dealt with in a dedicated law tract called Bac Breatha, the Bee Judgments. So the idea here was that in going about their nectar gathering business, bees could not, of course, know they were committing the offence of grazing trespass. The law tract's author, understanding that bees would innately move across artificial human boundary lines, came up with a clever solution, at least for handling most situations. So the idea was that when a person first started beekeeping, they were required to provide a forepledge, as mentioned. So an item of personal significance, pledged to their four nearest neighbours. This forepledge gave the original beekeeper immunity for 3 years from legal claims for offences committed by their bees. The sharing of honey with the community was nonetheless required in specific circumstances, such as where a neighbour might fall ill and honey had been prescribed by a physician. But in the fourth and fifth year, each of the neighbours in turn were entitled to a swarm from the hive of the original owner. And here was the genius part. Any trespasses by their newly acquired bees were deemed to cancel out those committed earlier by the first neighbor's bees. The first neighbor's forepledge was then also returned. Now, Bec Breatha also contains a very interesting rare reference in the Breatha laws to an apparent legal case involving a verifiable historical person, albeit the reputed facts of the case itself are suspect, but who knows, it's possible. Here it said that Congal Caoch, king of Tara, possibly sometime between 630 and 635 AD, was blinded in one eye by a bee. This ultimately cost him the kingship, which was a nod to the importance placed in early Ireland and the Breatha laws on kings being physically unblemished. Congal judged that a beehive should be forfeit for such a blinding injury, and that was identified by casting lots on suspect hives in the area. The bee judgments also go on to grapple with a number of complex scenarios regarding bee ownership and entitlements to their produce, such as when a tract swarm settled in a tree and or in the lands of privileged people, such as kings or clerics or poets. If someone happened to stumble upon stray bees in unowned land, though, so in forests or near lakes, they were seemingly permitted to fully claim the swarm. This was, though, still subject to an overarching community obligation to share some of the produce with their family and the church. So beyond that as well, the theft of bees was usually sternly dealt with, and the exact penalty depended on where the bees had been taken from. So if they were removed from a garden or courtyard of a house, the offence was treated with the same severity as if the thief had stolen items from within the house itself. And other interesting aspects of the law of farming and neighbourhood were if cattle of more than one owner were grazing at the same location and one animal killed the other, then the offending animal could be killed and the meat of both animals divided between the owners. And there's lots of examples of these kind of pragmatic legal rules throughout the law tracts in various respects.
Yeah, though that really prevented things to escalate in a way, like, and had some element of prevention in them. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay, well, I think we have a better idea now of you know, that assumptions that we make as practitioner. Maybe there is definitely something in the mindset of the Brehan laws around the importance of community and the idea of repairing. And especially I'm thinking of all what you said about the sick maintenance, you know, which is really a reparation process rather than just a, you know, a retribution of what happened. But definitely practices are quite different. Like, I mean, there is not that image. We have people sitting in a circle and discussing what happened. And I think we are quite far from that in many ways. But the mindset definitely is much more restorative than our current retributive system. Thank you very much for that.
Falter all, Dorte.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed our podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to our show.